Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Lydia Davis this time. Davis is an acclaimed fiction writer and translator, famous for her extremely brief, sometimes only a few sentences long, and brilliantly inventive short stories. In the fall of 2003, she received one of 25 MacArthur Foundation Genius Awards. In granting the award, the MacArthur Foundation praised Davis's work for showing how language itself can entertain, how all that what one word says and leaves unsaid can hold a reader's interest. Davis grants readers a glimpse of life's previously invisible details, revealing new sources of philosophical insights and beauty. In 2013, she won the prestigious Man Booker International Prize. Join me for Lydia Davis here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here in Portland, which I've never visited before. I'm going to read a talk. I wish I could talk the talk without reading it, but I just can't do that sort of thing, which is probably why I became a writer. You have plenty of time to think what you're going to say when you write. The talk will sort of trace my evolution, or at least it traces my evolution and my influences for a while, and then I kind of get carried away just talking about other work that I like that may or may not have influenced me. So the traditional novel, the traditional short story, and the traditional poetic forms, although they evolve, do not disappear. But there is a wealth of less traditional forms that writers have adopted over the decades and centuries, forms that are harder to define and less often encountered, forms that are either variations on the traditional, such as the short story, or are intergeneric, that sit on a line between poetry and prose, or fable and realistic narrative, or essay and fiction, and so on. I would like to talk about some of these more eccentric forms, and specifically about some of the ones I've read and thought about over the years as my own writing has evolved. So this talk includes something about my writing, but is predominantly an excuse to talk about and read from other people's writing, both poetry and prose. I think of myself as a writer of fiction, but my first books were slim, small press books, often shelved in the poetry section. And I'm still sometimes called a poet and included in poetry anthologies. It is understandable that there may be some confusion, but I think it is a healthy confusion. For instance, my collection of stories entitled Samuel Johnson is Indignant contains 56 pieces, including what could roughly be described as meditations, parables or fables, an oral history with hiccups, an interrogation about jury duty, a traditional though brief story about a family trip, a diary about thyroid disease, excerpts from a bad translation of a poorly written biography of Marie Curie, a fairly traditional narrative about my father and his furnace, though ending in an accidental poem, and scattered through the book brief prose pieces of just one or two lines and one or two pieces with broken lines. When I began writing or trying to write seriously and steadily in college, I thought my only choice was the conventional or traditional narrative short story. Both my parents had been writers of short stories, and my mother still was. Both of them had had stories published in The New Yorker. The New Yorker loomed large in our life as some sort of icon, though an icon of exactly what, I'm not sure. Maybe excellent writing and excellent editing, certainly urban wit and sophistication. By age 12, more or less, I already felt I was bound to be a writer, and that if you were to be a writer, the choices were limited. First, poet or prose writer. Then, if prose writer, novelist or short story writer. I never thought of being a novelist. Whether by nature or nurture, it was simply not in my temperament. My parents knew poets and sometimes read poetry out loud. I wrote poems early on, but to be a poet was somehow not a serious option for life. So if eventually some of my work comes right up to the line, if there is one, that separates a piece of prose from a poem and even crosses it, the approach to that line is through the realm of short fiction. In college, when I told one intelligent friend of mine with confidence and exuberance that my ambition was to write short stories, and specifically first, to write a short story that would be accepted by the New Yorker, he was startled by my certainty. He was also somewhat scornful and suggested that maybe this should not be the full extent of my ambition. I was so surprised by his reaction that the Manhattan street corner where we were talking is engraved on my memory, Broadway at 114th Street. My fixed ideas had been shaken. Although I now did not have quite the same confidence in the New Yorker, I did not immediately see an obvious alternative to writing short stories. So I continued to work at it and went on in that direction for the next several years, though the subject matter of the stories gradually moved away from the absolutely traditional. I found it rather a hard task, rather laborious. It was exciting only at moments. I worked at one short story for months and months. I worked at another off and on for about 2 years. I followed the traditional advice, combining invented material and material from my own experience. A story called Ways that I wrote at age 19 involves the relationship between a father and son in Buenos Aires. Here is the opening. This afternoon, the wind blew in gusts along the street. The women's cheeks warmed with color, their hair tousled. The men spread their woven and fringed scarves over their shoulders. Today was Sunday, the fruit stands boarded up, gratings lowered on all the storefronts. As the afternoon darkened, there were only a few breaks in the dusk in each block, a confiteria on the corner with its glass doors closed, men inside leaning over their tea, their scarves rumpled against their collars, their hands gesturing or cradling their cups in the cold and white light. But in addition to a healthy diet of more traditional short story writers like Catherine Mansfield, D.H. Lawrence, John Cheever, John Updike, and many more, I was already reading others who might have revealed how many other formal options there were. I'd been reading Samuel Beckett off and on for some years by then. I was in my early teens when I first laid eyes on a page of Beckett. I read only a little, but I was startled. I had come to it from a rich variety of reading that included the steamy books of the Jalna series by Mazo de la Roche, though not too steamy to be included in a very proper girls' school library, the more elevated romances of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, the textured, robust social panorama of John Dos Passos, the first writer whose style I consciously noticed and liked. Now, here was a book, Malone Dies, in which the narrator spent a page describing his pencil. And the first plot development was that he had dropped his pencil. I had never imagined anything like it. When I look at Beckett now to try to identify more exactly what were the qualities that continued to excite my interest as I went on reading his work over the years, trying to learn from him, I find at least the following, and I use as examples the fragments that I copied out because they were particularly appealing. There was his precise and sonorous use of the Anglo-Saxon vocabulary, especially in this example, the way he gives a familiar word like dint a fresh life by using it in an unfamiliar way. The flagstone before her door that by dint, her little weight has grooved. There was his use of Anglo-Saxon and alliteration to produce what were almost pieces of Old English verse. Worthy those worn by certain newly dead. There was his use of complex, almost impossibly tangled, yet correct syntax for the pleasure of it, though perhaps also as a commentary on composition itself. Were it not of him to whom it is speaking, speaking, but of another, it would not speak. There was his deft handling of image and his humor, almost certainly poking fun at a tradition of romantic or lyrical writing that I quite enjoyed. The Little Summer House, a rustic hexahedron. beginning with a would-be romantic description, the little summer house, and then exploding it with the technical word hexahedron. There was his acute psychological analysis, so closely accurate that it became absurd and yet moving at the same time. Not that Watt felt calm and free and glad, for he did not and had never done so. But he thought that perhaps he felt calm and free and glad, at least calm and free, or free and glad, or glad and calm, or if not calm and free, or free and glad, or glad and calm, at least calm or free or glad without knowing it. Here he is no doubt again poking fun at traditional sentimental writing. And lastly, there was his ability to balance the sonority of rhythm and alliteration with the unexpectedly moving depiction of character. So with what reason remains, he reasons and reasons ill. If Beckett interested me more for the way he handled language, the close attention to words, the mining of the richness of English, the ironic distance from prose style, the self-consciousness, and less for the forms in which he wrote, still, as with Joyce, Beckett's example provided a pattern of development through different forms over a lifetime of writing. Both these writers started by writing poetry and went on to write short stories and then novels. And then in Joyce's case, the longest and most eccentric novel, Finnegan's Wake. In Beckett's case, the plays and more eccentric fictions. Both evolved to a point where they seemed to leave more and more readers behind and write more and more for their own pleasure. I had as well the example of writers within the traditional form, but briefer, as for example, Isaac Babel, with his condensation, emotional intensity, and richness of imagery, especially in the Red Cavalry stories. One of these, crossing into Poland, ends with the thin pregnant woman standing over her dead old father. "Good sir," said the Jewess, shaking up the feather bed, "the Poles cut his throat, and he, begging them, kill me in the yard so that my daughter shan't see me die. But they did as suited them. He passed away in this room thinking of me. And now I should wish to know," cried the woman with sudden and terrible violence, "I should wish to know where in the whole world you could find another father like my father." The ending is abrupt. The story, for all its power, is only a little over 2 pages long. I had the example of Grace Paley, who defied conventional pacing and packed every sentence with so much wit, richness of character, and worldly wisdom that the lines were often explosive. Her story, Wants, is again all of 2 pages long. Here is the opening page. "I saw my ex-husband in the street. I was sitting on the steps of the new library. 'Hello, my life,' I said. We had once been married for 27 years, so I felt justified. He said, 'What? What life? No life of mine.' I said, 'Okay, I don't argue when there's real disagreement.' I got up and went into the library to see how much I owed them. The librarian said, $32 even, and you've owed it for 18 years. I didn't deny anything, because I don't understand how time passes. I have had those books. I've often thought of them. The library is only 2 blocks away. My ex-husband followed me to the book's returned desk. He interrupted the librarian, who had more to tell. 'In many ways,' he said, 'as I look back, I attribute the dissolution of our marriage to the fact that you never invited the Bertrams to dinner.' 'That's possible,' I said. 'But really, if you remember, first my father was sick that Friday, then the children were born. Then I had those Tuesday night meetings. Then the war began. Then we didn't seem to know them anymore. But you're right, I should have had them to dinner.' Yet I was apparently not ready to try the sort of story she was writing. And it took me another decade to see that you could take the material of a story very largely from your own life, as I suspect she did, or even, though in a selected version, entirely from your own life. I also had the example of Kafka's very brief Parables and Paradoxes, some of which were not even stories, of course, but meditations or logical problems. I studied them closely, yet I seemed to think that only Kafka, not I or anyone else, could write such odd things. They all work in slightly different ways. One, for instance, might be a reinterpretation of a familiar legend, as in The Sirens. These are the seductive voices of the night. The sirens, too, sang that way. It would be doing them an injustice to think that they wanted to seduce. They knew they had claws and sterile wombs, and they lamented this aloud. They could not help it if their laments sounded so beautiful. Another might be the creation of and commentary upon a ritual, as in Leopards in the Temple. Leopards break into the temple and drink to the dregs what is in the sacrificial pitchers. This is repeated over and over again. Finally, it can be calculated in advance, and it becomes a part of the ceremony. Another might be the reinterpretation of a moment of history, as in Alexander the Great. It is conceivable that Alexander the Great, in spite of the martial successes of his early days, in spite of the excellent army that he had trained, in spite of the power he felt within him to change the world, might have remained standing on the bank of the Hellespont and never have crossed it, and not out of fear, not out of indecision, not out of infirmity of will, but because of the mere weight of his own body. Kafka himself apparently was inspired by two of his contemporaries writing in the short form, the Swiss Robert Walser, who is now much more widely available in English, notably in translations done by Susan Bernofsky, and the Viennese cafe bohemian, Peter Altenberg, who has fairly recently appeared in English translations done by Peter Wartzman and published by Archipelago Press, and who, interestingly, seems to have composed his short narratives entirely from his own life. And if I could expand this talk infinitely, I would read some Peter Altenberg, who's really delightful. After ignoring the model of Kafka for so long, along with other possible more eccentric forms of writing, I was jolted into taking a new direction at last after reading a collection of stories by Russell Edson. I had been slogging away at a stubborn story for months on end. I had been fighting off my inertia and apathy. I would read, go for a walk, eat. In the midst of this inertia, a friend who had been witnessing it said, "You just sit around all day doing nothing." I wasn't doing nothing. I was agonizing. Then I read Russell Edson's book called The Very Thing That Happens. I was 26 then. Russell Edson is a very unusual writer. You could characterize many of his stories as bizarre, often funny, and abbreviated tales of domestic violence involving family members, but also sometimes their pots and pans, animals, buildings, parts of buildings, and so forth. But some of the pieces are lyrical meditations or sunnier moral tales. Russell Edson himself calls them poems, sometimes fables. Most of them seem to me entirely prose narratives. They too work in different ways. Here's what could be called a brief lyrical meditation on the idea of generations. Waiting for the signalman. A woman said to her mother, "Where is my daughter?" Her mother said, "Up you and through me and out of grandmother, coming all the way down through all women like a railway train, trailing her brunette hair, which streams back gray into white, waiting for the signalman to raise his light so she can come through." "What is she waiting for?" said the woman. "For the signalman to raise his light so she can see to come through."
Here is a rather brutal family interaction called Dead Daughter. "Wake up, I heard something die," said a woman to something else. Something else was her father. "Do not call me something else," he said. "Will it be something dead for breakfast?" said the woman. "It is always something dead given by your mother to her husband," said her father. "Like my dead daughter, dead inside herself. There is nothing living there, no heart, no child." "That is not true," said the daughter. "I am in here trying to live, but afraid to come out." "If you're in there, oh, do come out. We're having a special treat. Dead daughter for breakfast, dead daughter for lunch, and dead daughter for supper. In fact, dead daughter for the rest of our lives." And here is a drama involving inanimate objects as well as human beings. It's called When Things Go Wrong. A woman had just made her bed. A wall leaned down and went to sleep on her bed. So the ceiling decided to go to bed too. The wall and the ceiling began to shove each other, but it was decided that the ceiling had best sleep on the floor. But the floor said, "Get off of me because I am annoyed with you." And the floor went outside to lie in the grass. "Will you stop it, all of you," screamed the woman. But the rest of the walls yawned and said, "We're tired too." "Stop, stop, stop," she screamed. "It is all going wrong. It all is wrong, wrong, wrong." When her father returned, he said, "Why is my house destroyed?" "Because everything went wrong," suddenly screamed the woman. "Why are you screaming and why is my house destroyed?" said the father. "I don't know, I don't know, and I'm screaming because I'm very upset, father," said the woman. "This is very strange," said the father. "Perhaps I'll walk away, and when I return, things will be different." "Father," screamed the woman, "why do you leave me every time this happens?" "Because when I return, things will be different," said the father. I think Edson opened a path for me for several reasons. One reason was that not every one of his stories succeeded. Some were merely silly. Maybe this had to do with the way Edson went about writing them. Here is a report of how he works. I take it from Natalie Goldberg's book, Writing Down the Bones. Russell Edson read at the University of Minnesota several years ago. He said that he sits down at his typewriter and writes about 10 different short pieces at one session. He then comes back later to reread them. Maybe one out of the 10 is successful and he keeps that one. He said that if a good first line comes to him, the rest of the piece usually works. Here are some of his first lines. "A man wants an airplane to like him. A beloved duck gets cooked by mistake. A husband and wife discover that their children are fakes. Identical twin old men take turns at being alive." When I first read Edson's work, I found some of the stories brilliant, but others faltered. Yet the stories that did not quite succeed showed me two things that were helpful to a young writer. They showed more clearly how the stories were put together, and they showed how a writer could try something, fail, try again, partially succeed, and try again. A third thing the stories showed me, both the brilliant ones and the faltering ones, was how you could tap some very difficult emotions and let them burst out in an unexpected, raw, sometimes absurd form, that perhaps, in fact, setting oneself absurd or impossible subjects made it easier for difficult emotions to come forth. I read this book, and the next month I began writing paragraph-long stories, sometimes just one on one day, sometimes a little flood of them. I ended up with 27 little stories in that month. They too arose from different sources and worked in different ways. One used the landscape where I was living, taking real features of it but putting them together in such a way that the piece sounded like a fable or a fairy tale. In a house besieged. In a house besieged lived a man and a woman. From where they cowered in the kitchen, the man and woman heard small explosions. "The wind," said the woman. "Hunters," said the man. "The rain," said the woman. The army, said the man. The woman wanted to go home, but she was already home, there in the middle of the country, in a house besieged. Another was entirely made up, but was based on an emotional reality. The mother. The girl wrote a story, but how much better it would be if you wrote a novel, said her mother. The girl built a dollhouse. But how much better if it were a real house, her mother said. The girl made a small pillow for her father. But wouldn't a quilt be more practical, said her mother. The girl dug a small hole in the garden. But how much better if you dug a large hole, said her mother. The girl dug a large hole and went to sleep in it. But how much better if you slept forever, said her mother. Some of the stories remained unfinished, sketchy, incomplete. Some grew from their initial paragraph into a page or two, sometimes many pages. One of the longer stories was Mr. Knockley, which begins, "Last night my aunt burned to death." It was only much later that I realized that this story had very likely been influenced by an Edgar Allan Poe story, The Man in the Crowd, the main plot line of both stories being the narrator's obsessive pursuit of a man through the streets of a town. And over time, I've seen how certain forms, even the forms of nursery rhymes, may impress themselves on us when we hear or read them, and that some of our later work may slip right into these pre-established forms. These short stories as a group had a different feel to them from what I had done before. They were bolder, more confident, and more adventurous. They were more fun to write, and they came more easily. Whereas writing had often felt like hard labor before, now I began to enjoy writing. I did not go on to buy and read every one of Russell Edson's books over the years since then. One book was enough, as often even a single page of a piece of writing may be enough to influence a change of direction. But a couple of years ago, I bought a recent book of his called The Rooster's Wife. I'll read one more of his from that book, written or at least published about 40 years after the first pieces of his that I read, this one animating a reflection about the act of writing itself. New prose about an old poem. One day an old poem is carried away by the wind. Its poet is relieved. Now he won't have to be nice to it anymore. The poem was always too good to throw away, yet not good enough to publish. It lived with him, demanding to be reconsidered every so often. But even so, he sees he is not to be rid of the old poem. The wind in reverse has returned it to his desk. The old poem is glad to be home and wants to be read again. The poet reads it and realizes once again that it's too good to be thrown away. Perhaps he thinks he'll send it out in the next mail, knowing, of course, that he won't, and that he'll have to go on being nice to it for the rest of his life. Only recently did it occur to me that maybe a fairly new, very short piece of my own was in fact influenced by the one I just read by Edson. Here is mine, The Bad Novel. This dull, difficult novel I have brought with me on my trip, I keep trying to read it. I have gone back to it so many times, each time dreading it and each time finding it no better than the last time, that by now it has become something of an old friend. My old friend, The Bad Novel. That spate of short stories was the beginning of a major change of direction. I no longer felt that I had to write in accordance with an established traditional form. After that, although I remained loyal to the traditional narrative short story and revisited it from time to time, since it was, after all, a satisfying and resilient form, I also kept departing from it to try other forms. Sometimes the forms simply occurred to me, and sometimes they were directly inspired by another writer's piece of writing. About 12 years after I first read Russell Edson, for instance, I was reading a poem by Bob Perlman on a train going down the coast of California. What was he doing in this poem? He was incorporating a grammar lesson. I was startled. Could one really do that? Here's the beginning of Bob Perlman's poem called Seduced by Analogy. With afford, agree, and arrange, use the infinitive. I can't agree to die. With practice, imagine, and resist, use the gerund. I practice to live is wrong. A train or any public transportation is often a very good place to think and write. After I read this poem, I thought, why, you could teach French in a story. You could write the story in English, but incorporate French words and ideas about language. I began writing French Lesson 1, Le Meurtre, right there on the train, without any more plan than that. See the vache ambling up the hill, head to rump, head to rump. Learn what a vache is. A vache is milked in the morning and milked again in the evening, twitching her dung-soaked tail, her head in a stanchion. Always start learning your foreign language with the names of farm animals. Remember that one animal is an animal, but more than one are animaux, ending in A-U-X. Do not pronounce the X. These animaux live on a ferme. A good poem almost always offers you something surprising in the way of language and thinking, even if you can't figure out right away what it all means. Charles Bernstein is another interesting poet and one of the originators of the so-called language school of poetry. In fact, as with many schools, not all the poets associated with this one really belong there. Charles Bernstein is one who ventures into all sorts of new formal territories. He has even written the libretto of an opera based on, of all things, the work and life of the critic Walter Benjamin. One of Bernstein's long sectional poems includes a letter protesting a parking ticket. The poem letter is 26 lines long. I'll only read some of these lines. The summons charges me with parking at a crosswalk on the northeast corner of 82nd Street and Broadway on the evening of August 17, 1984. The space in question is east of the crosswalk on 82nd Street, as indicated by the yellow lines painted across the street. This space has been a legal parking space during the over 10 years I have lived on the block. Cars are always parked in the space, and have continued to, unticketed in several observations I made yesterday and today. Apparently, new crosswalk markings are currently being painted in white on both 82nd Street and 83rd Street. At this time, the process is not complete. When these new lines are finished, several spaces may be eliminated. However, as they looked at the time I received the ticket, they did not appear to override the yellow lines, according to which I was clearly in my right to park in the space. It is hard to say how this works as a poem. Certainly, it doesn't work by the same rules as the poem by Bob Perlman above, or one by Gerard Manley Hopkins, Margaret, Are You Grieving, Over Golden Grove, Unleaving, or one by Emily Dickinson, A Fly Buzzed When I Died. I read it as a poem de facto, partly because it has line breaks, partly because it is one section of a more obviously poem-like long poem, and partly because it is included in a collection of poems and is surrounded by other poems. The way we read a piece of writing is somewhat determined by the context in which we read it, and that in itself can open up new possibilities for a writer. Perhaps this unusual form of poem lodged in my brain somewhere so that years later a letter of complaint seemed a good form for a story. And I wrote Letter to a Funeral Parlor, objecting to the use of the word cremains. This letter started out as an actual, sincere letter and then got carried away by its own language and turned into something too literary to send. After I wrote that letter, I realized how many other things I had to complain about and wrote three more. Letter to a hotel manager, in which I objected to the misspelling on the menu of shrod, the famous Boston fish. Letter to a peppermint candy company, in which I reported that in the expensive tin of peppermints I had just bought, there were only 2/3 the number of peppermints the company claimed to have put in. And letter to a frozen peas manufacturer, as follows. Dear frozen peas manufacturer, we are writing to you because we feel that the peas illustrated on your package of frozen peas are a most unattractive color. We are referring to the 16-ounce plastic package that shows 3 or 4 pods, one of them split open, with peas rolling out near them. The peas are a dull yellow-green, more the color of pea soup than fresh peas, and nothing like the actual color of your peas, which are a nice, bright, dark green. The depicted peas are, moreover, about 3 times the size of the actual peas inside the package, which, together with their dull color, makes them even less appealing. They appear to be past their maturity and mealy in texture. Additionally, the color of your illustrated peas contrasts poorly with the color of the lettering and other decoration on your package, which is an almost harsh neon green. We have compared your depiction of peas to that of other frozen peas packages, and yours is by far the least appealing. Most food manufacturers depict food on their packaging that is more attractive than the food inside, and therefore deceptive. You are doing the opposite. You are falsely representing your peas as less attractive than they actually are. We enjoy your peas and do not want your business to suffer. Please reconsider your art. Yours sincerely. I actually did send that letter. But I discovered that Cascadian Farms was owned by General Mills, and General Mills ignored what I actually said in my letter and just sent me coupons for Jolly Green Giant peas. So. Some influences only reveal themselves long after the fact, but some are quite conscious. About 15 years ago, I was reading David Foster Wallace's brief interviews with hideous men. It was difficult to read because the men were truly hideous. But the form was a powerful one. In each interview, we were given the answers at length, but the questions were left blank. I didn't finish reading it, but I didn't forget the form. And sometime later, after I'd had the interesting experience of being on call for jury duty and wanted to write about it, this form felt like the right one to use. The material I used in my story, titled Jury Duty, was taken nearly completely from life, but the story was transformed into fiction by the illusion of the questioner or examiner. This is the opening of the story. Question, answer, jury duty. Question, the family. Question, 4 of us. Well, one doesn't live at home anymore, but he was home that night. He was leaving the next morning, the same morning I had to go into the courtroom. Question, answer. We were all 4 of us quarreling, every which way. I was just now trying to figure it out. There's so many different combinations in which 4 people can quarrel. 1-on-1, 2-against-1, 3-against-1, 2-against-2, etc. I'm sure we were quarreling in just about every combination. Question. Answer. I don't remember now. Funny, considering how heated it was. The forum is enjoyable because of what you can do with the unspoken questions. Sometimes it's obvious what the question has been. For instance, we know the questioner has had trouble understanding the name Sojourner Truth because it has to be repeated several times. But at other points in the story, it is not obvious what the questioner has asked. I end the story with the answer, yes. You never find out what the question was. Fairly recently, during the extended period of several years in which I was working on my translation of Proust's Swan's Way, not wanting to stop writing altogether and yet having no time, I tried another form that intrigued me, perhaps because I was spending the days translating such long, complex sentences, though I found it engrossing and even exciting. I wanted to see just how brief I could make a piece of writing and still have it mean something. Perhaps I'd been influenced by the postcard I had kept up on my bulletin board for years that contained a poem taken from a longer work by the poet Anselm Hollow. I shouldn't have started these red wool mittens. They're done now, but my life is over. Even though it's such a short poem, it surprises me each time I read it, which is something I think a good piece of writing should do. Perhaps also the idea for this very brief form was planted in me years ago by some of the entries in Kafka's diaries. For instance, here is one in its entirety. The picture of dissatisfaction presented by a street where everyone is perpetually lifting his feet to escape from the place on which he stands. In just a few words, he offers a different way of seeing a commonplace thing. I wanted to see if a piece of writing could be that short, a title and a line or two, and still have the power to move, or at least startle or distract in a way that was not entirely frivolous. I also wanted it to stay firmly in the realm of prose. Here is one that has some of the rhythms of the Anselm Hollow poem. Lonely. No one is calling me. I can't check the answering machine because I've been here all this time. If I go out, someone may call while I'm out. Then I can check the answering machine when I come back in. There are two that are shorter. Hand. Beyond the hand holding this book that I'm reading, I see another hand lying idle and slightly out of focus. My extra hand. Index entry. Christian, I'm not a. Hemingway famously once wrote a one-line short story when challenged to do so. But I'm not sure that it's a really good one. For sale, baby shoes never worn. But writers working in very short forms are usually poets. There's Samuel Menashe, whose interesting work is too often overlooked. Often he writes in just four short lines or eight short lines, and this is one in four short lines. Pity us by the sea, on the sands, so briefly. There is Laureen Niedecker, one of the lesser known poets of the so-called objectivist group that followed a generation or so after Ezra Pound. Here is one of her short, pithy poems. The museum man, I wish he'd take Pa's spitbox. I'm going to take that spitbox out and bury it in the ground and put a stone on top, because without that stone on top, it would come back. As in the last Edson piece I read about the poem that wasn't quite good enough, the Laureen Niedecker poem is about a thing that comes back to haunt, the thing having a life and will of its own. Although it seems so simple, it has, besides its humor and its powerful, complex, direct emotion, a nicely balanced construction. Then there is an interesting, rather anarchic poet near Woodstock, New York, known only as Sparrow. He is famous, in small circles anyway, for picketing the reception area of the New Yorker for several days. I forget how many, protesting because the magazine published only bland, predictable poetry rather than offbeat, eccentric poetry, such as in particular his own. Eventually, in fact, the magazine bought three of his poems and published at least one of them. I guess sometimes it pays to be persistent and to protest. Sparrow has written many very small poems. The poems of his that interest me are not lyrical. I like the ones in which he is seeing things in a different way. One of his goes like this, poem. This poem replaces all my previous poems. Here's another, a little longer. It's called Money Back Guarantee. If you are dissatisfied with this poem in any way, return it to Sparrow, P.O. Box 63, Phoenicia, New York, 12464. He will mail you a refund within 6 to 8 days. Only this poem contains this unique offer. He has another small poem called Perfection Wasted. The problem with dying is you can't be funny anymore or charming. When I read this, I thought it was an original poem of his, but in fact it is a translation of a sonnet by John Updike that appeared in The New Yorker. I found it in a group of poems by Sparrow called Translations from The New Yorker. This was in a book of his called America, A Prophecy, The Sparrow Reader, published by Soft Skull Press, which contains a lot of prose as well as poetry and is very amusing and interesting to a writer because it is so much about writing and so fresh and opinionated. Another translation of his is Garter Snake. I'll read Sparrow's translation first. A snake moved through grass and I watched. It looked like an S. When it stopped, it was very still. The grass shook slightly when it moved. The original has a lot more words in it, which is one thing I suppose Sparrow is trying to get away from. Here is the first verse of the original. The stately ripple of the garter snake in sinuous procession through the grass compelled my eye. It stopped and held its head high above the lawn, and the delicate curve of its slender body formed an S, for serpent, I presume, as though diminutive majesty obliged embodiment. That's the first verse. Farther along in the poem, where Sparrow's translation reads, the grass shook slightly when it moved, the original is, it gave the rubbled grass and the dull hollows where its ripples ran lithe scintillas of exuberance, moving the way a chance felicity silvers the whole attention of the mind. That's the end of the poem. Sparrow's plainer version may not quite make it as a poem, and in any case, some readers will prefer the richer original. But his translations raise several interesting questions about writing, including whether you can say the same thing in radically different ways, which is, of course, one of the basic questions posed by translations from other languages. Are you, in fact, saying the same thing? And I'll stop here rather arbitrarily with that question, which could open a whole other talk that would go on for several days, I think. Thank you.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was Lydia Davis. She spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 2009. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces The Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time to find your story here.